Welcome to our Goldster Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the ever-popular genre of crime writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Conversation. I am thrilled today to welcome somebody who isn't actually here. I'm going to be talking to J.D. Kirk. But who is J.D. Kirk? Do you want to tell us who you are and where J.D. comes from?
Yeah, J.D. Kirk is a man who does not exist. My real name is Barry Hutchison. I am a former children's author. I wrote children's books for about 10 years for HarperCollins and Penguin, Random House and Bloomsbury and various others. And then 2019, I decided I was going to write a crime fiction novel, and I made up the name J.D. Kirk because I didn't really want children who'd been reading my kids' books to stumble upon the crime fiction. So the name J.D. Kirk, I don't know what J.D. stands for. It could be anything. My daughter suggested either John Doe, which is what they call, you know, dead bodies found without any ID, or J.D., J-A-Y-D-E-E, just because she liked the idea of confusing people. And Kirk, really, in all honesty, came from the fact that I really like Star Trek. So it was Captain Kirk. And so yeah, and it was a nice short name because my surname Hutchison, everyone always inserted an extra N and made it Hutchinson. Even HarperCollins printed 5,000 posters with my name Hutchinson. So I decided, well, you can't really spell Kirk wrong.
No.
So I thought it's a nice simple one to do. So that's where J.D. Kirk came from. That is my crime writing persona.
Well, so you have had an incredibly varied and really successful career. Tell us how you first got started. Did you always want to write, or was it something that you just kind of fell into?
No, I wanted to be an author since I was 9 years old. And I was, it's all really thanks to my local librarian, Mrs. McAllister at the time. I didn't read many books when I was younger. I read comics all the time. I read The Beano and I read The Dandy and Spider-Man and Superman and all that stuff. And the teacher I had in primary school hated the fact that I read comics, and she hated comics and thought there was terrible art form. We went to the library one day to meet the new librarian, Mrs. McAllister, and we all had to stand up and introduce ourselves and say what type of books we like to read. And the teacher made me go last and just said, "Right, Barry, stand up and tell Mrs. McAllister what you like to read." So I stood up and kind of really sheepishly said, "I like to read comics." And Mrs. McAllister said, "Oh, wait there a minute." And she went through the back and she came back with this massive stack of comics that Dinos and Dandies and said, "Boof,
both
read them." And I came back to the library every day and read comics. And then she started sort of pushing books on me as well. So she would go like, "Oh, you're reading a comic about robots. Well, here's a book about robots." And she would sort of start luring me into books that way. And then I went in one day and I asked for a book about ninjas. So I was obsessed with ninjas at that point for about a week. And she didn't have any books about ninjas, but she went through the back again and she came through and said, "Here's a notebook, go and write a book about ninjas." And I wrote this terrible short story and I brought it back to her. And to her credit, she not only read it, but she wrote my name on the spine of the notebook and she put it.
Oh, that's so lovely.
It was one of those moments, you know, like in films when the clouds part and there's the big sort of shaft of sunlight and the choir of angels sing and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to have other books with my name on the spine on bookshelves and libraries. And it took a while. I started writing film scripts. So I sold a film script when I was 17, so I wrote a few of those. And then I had my first book published in 2010. Yes, 2010. I wrote it in 2007. It got picked up by HarperCollins in 2008, and it came out in 2010. So, but yeah, I was 9 when I decided that writer was the job that I wanted.
Well, that librarian, what a great thing to have done. I mean, people like that, they really do stay with us, don't they?
That's absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Story.
And so when you hear about the number of libraries being closed, and I know so many authors the fact that they are authors to libraries.
Yeah.
And so we hear that yet another library's been closed or whatever. It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, and they're so vitally important for the community. I know I interviewed for one of our other shows recently a librarian, and lots of people were talking about, you know, their experiences in libraries and how vital they were for not just for their childhood, but all through every stage of their life.
Yeah, and more so now than ever, I think. When everyone's expected to have access to the internet and all that stuff, it's, you know, they're a lifeline to so many people.
So you've done a huge amount of different genres, but let's concentrate on your J.D. Kirk books for the moment.
Okay.
So tell us, who is DCI Jack Logan?
So DCI Jack Logan kind of popped into my head one day in about 2016, 2017, I would say. My daughter and I were out walking in the place called Leinikin Forest up here in the Highlands, which is about 10 miles from our house. And we were out walking the dog. We're in this sort of stretch where there was like a path that went on for about a mile in each direction. And the dog disappeared into the trees. My daughter started to panic because the dog wasn't coming back. So I said, right, wait here. I'll go find the dog and I'll come back. So I went and found the dog. I came back and my daughter had vanished. And I immediately was in sort of panic attack mode. I thought, well, one, she's gone. Two, my wife's going to kill me for this. And I, because I looked both directions, there was no sign of her. I thought, well, she can't have wandered off. So someone must have come and taken it. And then I started shouting in panic. The dog started barking in panic and sensing I was sort of distressed. And then my daughter popped up from behind a bush laughing her head off.
Oh, God.
So she was about six at the time.
Oh,
so just the age to think that was hilarious. And by the time I got home, though, I thought, well, what would have happened if she hadn't been there, if she hadn't popped up? You know, what would happen next? And I started thinking about how the investigation might play out and all that stuff. And by the time I was home, I had this idea for this book in my head. And I didn't really know who DCI Jack Logan was at all. It took me a couple of years to kind of sit down. I wanted the books to be really sort of dark and gritty and proper crime fiction stuff. A lot of the stuff I'd done before that was sort of humor, was comedy. I'd done the kids' books and I'd also written comedy science fiction. I'd written loads of comics. I wrote for The Beadle for about 3 or 4 years. And so I wrote The Bass Street Kids, which is one of my proudest achievements. Bass Street Kids, Banana Man, Calamity James, Nashua Nipper, Dennis's Dogs, and various other ones. But it was all the sort of funny stuff I'd done. So I want this to be really dark and gritty. And I kind of tried multiple times to get it right, and I couldn't get there. And then something happened, and I thought, I'm going to try it slightly differently, and I'm going to try with just a sort of suggestion of humour in it. And I made the detective, he's up from Glasgow, so he's kind of that fish out of water in the Highlands. He's used to sort of the modern trappings of the big city, and now suddenly he's in the middle of nowhere trying to deal with this missing child investigation. So I quite liked that whole fish out of water thing. And then I built the team around him, and their relationships kind of became key to the series going forward. So one of the sort of the USP of the series, I suppose, is the humour. It's very, they are proper crimes, they're proper investigations, but there's a sort of seam of humour running through them all that people seem
to I like that humour. I think it works really well.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, part of it comes from talking to people that work in the emergency services, you know, and they say the only way they can deal with all the things they have to deal with is if they can have a sort of switch off and have a sense of humour and have a laugh with their colleagues. And it's not disrespectful, it's just blocking that part off, and it's the only way they can get through the day. Otherwise, they're going to be, you know, they're not going to come back to work on day two.
Yeah, absolutely. We've already got a comment in someone said, I absolutely love the DCI Jack Logan books. I've read them all.
Thank you very much.
Super fan in the audience here. So when you started working on the character, what do you do when you come up with a character? Do they just kind of appear fully formed? Do you kind of try them out for different sizes?
Yeah, they mostly appear fully formed. I tend to, I have this idea that I'm going to do. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to figure out a character in detail. I'm going to go, right, where do they go to school? What kind of music do they like? What kind of music do they hate? You know, what foods do they like? How would they spend their perfect Friday night? So I have this big list of things to figure out, and I rarely get around to it because they kind of pop in and I already sort of instinctively know who they are. So I don't generally do a lot of work developing them. I just sort of trust them to sort of reveal themselves, if you know what I mean. So a lot of my writing, I find it's not a conscious thing. I don't think, okay, this character is going to do this. It's almost like it's in my fingers and I'll write, and then I'm kind of reading it as it appears on screen, and I go, oh yeah, that works. So it's like it sort of bypasses the brain a little bit and goes straight to the fingers. So now I've kind of gone back afterwards and you go, okay, now I know these things about that character. I'm not sitting down and consciously coming up with them. It's just these things have come out and I now know how all the characters would react in any given situation, which is a really nice position to be in, because then you can just go, okay, here's what's happening. And then it's almost just standing back and watching as these people that you've come to know just deal with it in their own way. And you're just almost sort of recording it for posterity.
It is really fascinating how things just take on their life of their own. And you think, where did that come from?
Yeah, I've got no idea.
Where they were going to do that.
I mean, there was a point in one of the books, without giving any spoilers away, when it's in one of the spin-off series from the D.C. Logan books, and a character goes to a house. And in my head and in the plan, that house was empty. And then it isn't. And there's a relative of that character living in that house who wasn't there until that sentence, until they opened the door and that character was suddenly there. And I have no idea where that character came from and is now one of the most popular characters in the entire series. You know, and I've now used that character in multiple books and they just appeared out of nowhere. To my surprise, I was like, oh, this person's here now. Okay, so I now need to deal with this, you know. So it is really interesting how it just sort of out of the brain, sort of subconscious is going, no, what this needs is this.
Yeah.
That you'd sort of just strap it in.
And so do you find that even when you're not at your desk, those characters are just living with you all the time? Do you find
it absolutely
difficult to switch off from them?
Yeah, I don't, like, I feel that it's... my wife always tells me to go write things down almost as if it's like a form of like an exorcism, like, because if there's something in my head, well, there's a scene and that scene is going to keep playing out until I can write it down. So it's like it's jammed in there somewhere and I know, okay, well, what if that happens in something? You know, and that might be a book that I don't write for another 5 years, but I have an idea for a scene or a conversation that's happening or just a situation a character's found themselves in. And that will be stuck in my head until I can go, right, okay, I'll write it down, whether it's handwrite it as a note or, but it just gets jammed in there. So my poor wife, I end up just talking to her, say, oh, this is what I'm thinking. This, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And then she'll just go and write it down. And I'll have to go and sneak away and write it down to get rid of it, you know. So it's a strange thing.
Yeah. So you write incredibly fast and you're extremely prolific. When did you decide that you wanted to self-publish, that you were fed up with traditional publishing?
It wasn't actually a conscious decision at first. So when I was writing the kids' books, a lot of children's authors make much of their income from doing speaking events. So that could be speaking at libraries, speaking at book festivals. In Scotland, we have the Scottish Book Trust, who pay authors to go into schools and deliver workshops or, you know, just sessions on books, just to try and kind of instill a love of reading in kids. So in 2016, I was asked to go to a school in Elgin in the north of Scotland to talk about how kids there could publish their own books. It was a high school, and the kids that I was going to be talking to were sort of between 14 and 16, and they wanted to know how they could self-publish their own books. And I had no idea, because as far as I knew, you typed a book in a computer, you emailed it to a publisher in London, and then 6 months to 2 years later, a book appeared in the world. And that was my entire understanding of the process. But I thought, well, they want me to go in and spend a week at this school, and so I'm going to learn how to publish a book myself. So I wrote a comedy science fiction novel called Space Team. And I wrote it in about 2 weeks, I think. And I thought, well, I'll put this on Kindle. Designed the cover myself because I knew kids wouldn't have money to pay a cover designer, and I edited it myself because kids don't have money to pay an editor. And I thought, I'll create this thing myself. I'll upload it to Kindle and then I'll understand how the process works. So then I could be in a position to go to the school and talk to kids and tell them how they can publish their own book. So I did that in September 2016. I then went away on holiday in October, and by the time I came back, that book was outselling my 150 children's books combined.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, that's interesting.
And had you done any kind of publicity about it?
No, nothing. I didn't have. It wasn't meant to be a book. Almost, it was just a learning experience for me. So I hadn't spent any money on it. I didn't spend any money on the whole process until the third book was published, because I wrote the second book fairly quickly after that one. And then the third book was out by March the following year. And at that point, I was earning more in a day from those three self-published books than in 6 months from 150 books with traditional publishers. And so I kind of thought then, well, this is creatively really rewarding. I was struggling with some of the kind of relationships I have with publishers. Many of them were great, but some were, you know, an editor would go, I love this idea. And they would take it to a meeting and the sales and marketing team would say, oh, we love this idea. This is perfect. But could you put a unicorn in it? Because unicorns are really popular at the moment.
Yeah.
And I would kind of go, well, it's not really a place to put a unicorn in this book. And they would say, well, either you put a unicorn in it or we can't publish it. So it was then either put a unicorn in it or go to a different publisher and start the entire process again. So I was becoming a bit sort of disillusioned with the whole thing anyway. And then when I was doing it myself, I was able to write the books I wanted to write with no input from anyone else, for better or worse, you know. And I was able to put them out almost immediately without having to wait, you know, a year for the publisher to get around to publishing them. So creatively, it was really rewarding. And financially, it was, you know, it was night and day compared to what traditional publishing was doing for me. So I saw no real reason to go back to publishing traditionally. And so when it came around, I ended up writing 12 books in that series, the Space Team series, and a 3-book spin-off and various other things. And then when it came to writing the crime fiction, I thought, well, why would I go to a traditional publisher with this when I could do it myself, just as I've done with the other stuff? And it was going to be one book, the crime fiction. It was like I just had the one idea, put it out, and then within a week, it was outselling the science fiction stuff like 100 to 1. And I thought, okay, I'll do this for a while now instead.
And so you say for a while. How long have you been doing this for now?
Crime fiction since first book was published in May 2019. So we're now...
You've written a huge number in a very short space of time.
Yeah, book 18 comes out next week, or a week after. So within the next couple of weeks anyway. And I did a 4-book spin-off series, the Bob Hoon spin-off series. So that's the first book. It's called Northwind. There were going to be 3 books, but the first one's called Northwind, the second one's called Southpaw, and the third one is called Westward. And it was my son who said, you can't not have a 4th book in that series. You can't not have one that starts with East.
So I would have thought exactly the same.
Yeah, so that's a fair point. So I ended up writing a 4th one. So, and then I started a new spin-off series about another character called Detective Inspector Heather Filson, and that came out earlier this year, and book 2 comes out in January. So I've written 23 J.D. Kirk books since the first one was published in May 2019.
So, and you're holding up physical books up, and I've got them on Kindle. So how does that work? When do you decide how you're going to get actual books? Do you sell them solely online? Do they go into bookshops? What do you do with your distribution?
So to start with, and what most sort of self-publishers do, they will use Amazon's platform to produce both the Kindle books, so they'll have the Kindle version on there, and they will do a print-on-demand version. And a print-on-demand version basically means if somebody goes to Amazon and buys that book, a machine somewhere in the world prints out a single copy of that book. Someone then takes that book, puts it in an envelope, and posts it to whoever bought it. So they'll print one copy at a time. And that's what I was doing to start with, and that's what most sort of self-publishers will do. In 2020, I think, thereabouts, we actually did a deal with the distribution company and we got a printer on board. So we do proper print runs like any other publisher now. We're a fully fledged publisher, essentially, that only publishes my books at the moment. So we have sales agents in New York. We have sales agents in the UK. We have audio studio working with us to produce audiobooks. And we have distributors in Glasgow and London and use print companies all over the world. So we're a proper fully fledged publisher At the moment, we just published my books, but we are looking to start publishing other authors quite soon.
And this is a family business, isn't it? Am I right? It's you and your wife and now your son well getting involved?
My wife and I formed the company. We're both directors of it. My son, he's in university studying business and marketing. His plan is to move to the US and start an imprint of the company in the US once he graduates. But he works for us at the moment and deals with lots of stuff that I can't be bothered dealing with, basically. So I started off just as an author, and then I became a publisher, self-publisher, doing everything myself. You know, I was designing covers, I was editing, I was doing the whole lot myself. And now I'm working my way back to just being an author again, but an author who happens to own the publishing company that's publishing his books.
Yeah. Well, we've got questions coming in, so I'm going to ask them. We've got a question here. Do you ever sleep?
Probably not as much as I should, as you can probably tell by looking at my face. If I wake up during the night, then I'm awake, and I'll have woken up because something has popped into my head. So I'm often at my keyboard at 3 o'clock in the morning because I've woken up at 2:30 with an idea, and I knew I couldn't go back to sleep. Still, so there's lots of sort of midnight oil being burned over the years.
We've been asked, do you narrate your audiobooks? If not, who does, and how did you find them?
I don't narrate them. I'm a big believer in finding people that are the best people for the job. And that's what I started doing because I used to do covers myself. I used to edit myself, but I'm not a cover artist. I'm not an editor. So as soon as I was able to outsource those to people that could do them better, then that's what I did. And it's the same with the audiobooks. I think there's nothing worse than listening to my voice for 12 hours nonstop. So I looked for a narrator. There's a guy called Angus King who narrates them. He's an amazing narrator. Very lovely guy as well. Lives in Edinburgh. But when I went first went looking for a narrator for the audiobooks, I put out like an open audition and said, you know, I want a Scottish accent to read these books. And it's about a male detective. So I want a male Scottish accent reading them. And I got about 20 auditions from Americans who were trying to do Scottish accents, really unconvincingly. It was like, and it's like, oh no, this isn't going to work. So I went looking for a Scottish narrator, and I found Angus, and I'd heard a couple of samples. I thought, he sounds pretty good, and I sent him the first kind of 500 words of the book, and said, if you're interested, do you want to read that? And I think I got about halfway through the first sentence, and I knew that he was the guy that was going to do them. So he's now done 22 books with me. He's absolutely instrumental to the success of the audiobooks. More and more people are switching to audio, and I think Angus is the reason. And even I quite like them, because I hate reading my own books. Like if I look at one of my own books, I go, oh, no, that's terrible. I should have changed that. I should have done that. But when I listen to them, it's like I'm listening to something that somebody else wrote, because just hearing them in a different format. And Angus's delivery, and he delivers it maybe in ways that weren't how I wrote it, but are either just, you know, different, so refreshing or better, or because he's a, you know, classically trained actor and all that stuff. And he does all the voices, and he's amazing. And yeah, he transforms it even for me. So I can understand why more and more people are listening to the audio versions.
And so when you decided to do audiobooks, was it an audiobook company that came to you, or did you decide, like with self-publishing, I'm going to set this up? And if so, what was your process in doing it?
We decided to do it all ourselves. We've done it. We have been approached by lots of different people, audio publishers, traditional publishers who kind of want to take over the DCR Logan stuff. But I'd done with Space Team. I had audiobooks done of that. And at that point, I had no money to spend. So I did a deal with a narrator who had never narrated an audiobook before, but he was another one that I heard his audition and I knew within three words that he was the guy that was going to do it. And I did a deal with him. Audible has a platform. So Audible is the audiobook, kind of the big audiobook company owned by Amazon. And they have a platform called acx.com. And it's Audible Creative Exchange. And that kind of pairs up authors and narrators. So on there, you can do a revenue share. So rather than pay any money, which I couldn't afford to do at that stage, you do a split, and it says, you know, the author gets 50% of the royalties and the narrator gets 50% of the royalties. And the dream scenario is that you both make money from it. Mm-hmm. So found Phil on there. We did the 50-50 split deal, and the audiobooks did quite well. And we ended up doing 16 books and a collection of short stories together, Phil and I. And by the time the sort of third book was out, I could have afforded to just pay him a flat fee, but he was so instrumental to the success that I wanted him to share with the income that the books were getting, you know, forever. So so we did that revenue share just throughout. When it came to the DCI Logan, did exactly the same thing. Basically went on ACX, looked around for Scottish narrators, found Angus on there. I had put the audition out on ACX, and that's where all the American auditions came from. But found Angus on there, just contacted him directly and said, this is what I'm doing. Do you want to have a read? Are you interested? And then just kind of sorted out that way between us. So it makes it very easy. Amazon are very keen to get as many people as possible publishing. So they make publishing on Kindle very, very easy. They make publishing your paperback easy. And they make publishing your audiobook easy as well.
Yeah. Chris, so we've got a really interesting question here from Pauline. So why are publishers being so obtuse?
I don't know. I think there's a big change coming in publishing, I think. And I think lots and lots of big name authors are soon going to realize that they can do a lot of the things that publishers do for themselves. You know, when I think back to what publishers actually did for me, now obviously they produced the books. That's fine. You can do that yourself. They generally didn't do much marketing. The way publishing works is they will kind of publish 100 books and sort of throw them at the wall, and then they'll watch very closely and see if any of them stick. Mm-hmm. And if any of them start selling well, then they put marketing money behind that book. The other 99 probably won't get any marketing budget whatsoever. And so the author was expected to do that marketing. So I was always expected to kind of do my own marketing. My books did reasonably well and won some awards and all that stuff, but I was up against, so with HarperCollins, I had, we have David Walliams, obviously in the UK, big children's author, celebrity prior to that. And so, you know, his books would come out through HarperCollins around about the same time that mine would. One of mine came out the same day as one of his big books, Gangster Granny. So he got all this money chucked at him, and my books were sort of left to fend for themselves, and I had to do all the marketing. Now, when you're doing the marketing for a book that is traditionally published, you have no idea if anything's working. So I could go, right, I'm going to do a blog post, or I'm going to tweet this, or I'm going to do a Facebook competition. Now, I have no idea if that resulted in any more sales until 6 months later, and I'll get a royalty statement that will cover a six-month period and tell me how many books sold overall within that six-month period. They don't tell me what days they sold. They don't tell me where they sold. They just tell me these are the number of books that sold during that time. But that's quite a hindrance when you're trying to do any marketing. So now when I have access to a dashboard that literally shows me every minute if a book is sold, I can go, right, I'm running a competition. I'm targeting, you know, Germany, and I'm going to run this competition, and I will watch, and I can see it instantly if that competition has resulted in any more book sales. And if it has, then I go, okay, I can do that again. I repeat that process. If it doesn't, I go, okay, that doesn't work as a marketing tool, so I don't do that again. So the information you get by being self-published allows you to market effectively. So I was doing all the marketing myself, and I just realized that, you know, they're putting more and more money into celebrity fiction publishers, whether it's, you know, crime fiction authors, they're getting some celebrities in, or children's fiction has been taken over at this point by celebrities. And I thought, so that's their focus, is doing that. And I thought, well, you know, I can just do it myself. And I think more and more authors are realizing that they can do it themselves as well. So I think we're going to see a pretty seismic change in publishing over the next 5-6 years.
We've got a comment here after that. I always wondered how celebrity books get published so quickly. Now I know it. It seems very unfair. I love your approach and determination.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, yeah. And most celebrity books are not actually written, of course, by the celebrities themselves. There's a big outcry at the moment. Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things has written a book. and has been doing the sort of chat show circuit, you know, saying I've written this and it's about that. And she didn't write it. It was a ghostwriter wrote it. And and they're sort of just disguising that fact. And I think, you know, that's quite like, I think if you're open about it, then, you know, if it's Millie Bobby Brown in partnership with this author.
Absolutely. Working with someone who's actually got the trade to produce it. It's so strange how celebrities refuse to actually accept.
I don't understand. The problem with it is that, you know, Millie Bobby Brown, for not writing that book, will have been paid many, many magnitudes more than the author who did write the book.
Absolutely.
And you can't really blame the celebrity. If someone came to me and said, do you want £1 million not to write a book?
Okay.
And I would go, yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah, fine.
If anyone out there wants to give either of us £1 million to write a book for them, we're both available to hire. We might even split it between us.
But I just don't, I don't know. It wouldn't sit easily with me to be taking credit for something I hadn't done.
No, I know. That's what I find really strange is why not just have to say so-and-so with. Now, we have a question here. What is your writing regime? And before Barry answers that, I just want to say that I have total desk envy, because for those of you who are watching this live, you might have noticed that he's actually standing up.
And at my desk.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Tell us all about it.
So it happened a few years ago. Well, maybe about 18 months ago, actually. I decided that I needed to, because I was writing all the time, and I thought I need to get exercise in. I need to do more exercise. And I thought I would get a standing desk so I can write standing up. And that's better for you than, you know, than writing sitting down. And then I thought, well, I could improve on that if I get a treadmill and put the treadmill under my desk. So when I'm writing, I can walk on the treadmill. The first couple of times, I won't lie, ended badly. I tried it. And I got shot off the back into the shelf full of Lego there, which took a bit of rebuilding. But after sort of 3 or 4 attempts, I found it not necessarily, it didn't come naturally, but I was able to kind of improve at it. And I started off just writing emails and things. Well, I can't be creative while walking on a treadmill. That's mad. But I can deal with admin. But fairly quickly, I thought I'm going to try writing. And now I've got to the point when I find it more difficult to be creative when sitting down. I think creativity sort of flows more when I'm walking. And when I'm writing exciting parts of a book, I speed the treadmill up to like, you know, 9 or 10 miles an hour. So I'm literally running on the spot and trying to write at the same time. So it's all gibberish that I write when I do that, but you know, I can fix it later. But the sort of the excitement, the energy goes into it is the hope.
I'd love you to have a neuroscientist or someone work out if it's actually doing something to your writing when you're.
It would be very interesting. So I generally write about 4,000 words and walk about 12,000 steps is my plan in a day. So I do that. I get up, start in the morning. I generally try to finish writing by about 12 o'clock in the day. And I will literally break down. I'll go, right, I have the next book I want to write is 100,000 words, let's say. And I have, you know, 30 days to write it, because I set myself these arbitrary deadlines. Because I work best the deadlines, because that's what I used to do with traditional publishers. So I go, okay, this deadline is 30 days from now, and break that up. And that works out at 3,500 words a day, and I'll aim for 4,000, because then I've got, if something goes wrong one day and I've got to take a day off, then I've got ahead. So I literally break down number of words, number of days, and that's how many words I have to write. And my aim is to be finished those by 12 o'clock. If I'm not finished those by 12 o'clock, then I just keep on writing until I am.
And we've got a couple of people want to know the same thing. Are you physically typing at the time, or are you dictating it?
Physically typing, I cannot dictate. I've tried many times. My mind just goes blank. It's all in my, I'm sure the story comes from my fingers. I have this thing called aphantasia. And what that means is I have no mental pictures. Like, I think exclusively in words. So, you know, people will say, oh, shut your eyes and picture a beach. I will just think of words that are connected to beach. I'll go, okay, sand, sea. There's nothing visual. It's just all darkness. Right. And I think that's one of the reasons that I write quickly, because I think, and it could be wrong, but I think lots of authors picture a scene or picture a character, and then they have to translate that picture into words. But for me, it starts off as words, and I don't have to have that sort of translation step between the two, and I can just write it as the words come into my head. So it's almost like a kind of conduit for just the whole the story, and I just type it. But I can't dictate. I've tried it a few times, and I was like, okay, I've got all these ideas. Then I just go, and nothing comes out. I just can't form sentences when I'm dictating. I don't know why.
So you said you try and write around 4,000 words a day. Do you ever have days where that just doesn't happen? And if so, how do you deal with it?
Very rarely do I have days that doesn't happen. I look at it and that kind of comes from necessity. When I was writing the kids' books, you know, I wrote 150 kids' books in 10 years. Sometimes I was writing 3 or 4 books at once because a publisher would, you know, I'd be writing my own books that are under my own name, but a publisher would say, we need someone to write this, you know, nonfiction book by next Friday. Can you do it? And I would say, are you going to pay me money? And then say, yes, we are. And then I would do it. And that would be, so I would, I was always having to work and I always had these deadlines, you know. So I've completely forgot, blanked out completely. What was the question you asked me then? Well, I do this every time.
What would you do basically if you get writer's block?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So I don't let myself get writer's block. I because, you know, I think it's a very easy excuse to give ourselves as writers. And I used to get it all the time. And I would go, right, okay, I can't, it's not coming today, so I'll chill out and I'll do it tomorrow, I'll do whatever. But now I go, and this is through the conditioning of those children's books. It's like, right, I need to write this number of words or my children don't eat, you know, because this is my job.
So that's your galvanizing.
So it's like, it's literally that this is the job that I have signed up to do. And so I suppose it's just sort of self-discipline of going, well, I need to do this job. I can't give myself excuses. You can't be a policeman and go, oh, I've got policeman's block, I can't solve any crimes today. You know, that's not allowed. Your job is to solve crimes. Or you're a surgeon, your job is to operate on people. You can't say, no, I'm not in the right mindset to do that today. It's just not happening. The knife just won't cut. You'd have to do that job. So as a writer, my job is to write. And I just don't allow myself to get writer's block. There are days when it's much, much easier to write than others. And there's days when I'll be finished my, you know, 4,000 words by 10 o'clock in the morning because I've just gone out of my head. And there are days when I'm still writing at 4 o'clock in the afternoon because I'm going and having to drag the words out. But my job is to put words on the page. And if I'm not doing that, then I'm not doing my job.
So on the other side of the coin, when you ever go on holiday, do you find that you just literally can't because you've got to write a certain number of words each day, or do you manage to switch off?
No, if I know I'm on holiday, then I can switch off from the writing part. But I have to have a notebook with me because things will be coming into my head all the time. You know, so I'll be talking to someone and midway through I'll think, oh, there, sir, which is kind of what happened when I was chatting to you earlier on. But yeah, I asked that question earlier. Something popped into my head, but a book idea that I'm going to have to go and write down in a minute. So things just pop in all the time. And if I don't write them down, then either they will plague me forever or they'll be lost and I'll never remember them again.
Yeah.
So I don't take time off from thinking about writing, but when I deliberately take a break, then I don't write during that. But I also have to time it. So, you know, I'm going on holiday next week. We're away for kind of 3 weeks. And I just managed to finish my next book 2 days ago, so Wednesday, finished it then. So first draft, there'll be a rewrite and everything coming after that. But if I hadn't finished that first draft, then my holiday would have been hell because I would have been thinking I need to be writing. I shouldn't be finishing this book. So the fact that I was able to finish it was great because then it's like, right now I can switch off. And now I will tackle the edit when I get back. And no doubt by the time I come back, I will have, you know, 10 more story ideas and I'll have a new subplot for the book I just finished. But I can deal with that when I get back.
So with your self-publishing as well, do you still get approached by traditional publishers and do you still do work for them as well? Or do you concentrate entirely on your own empire now?
I've been approached by lots of different traditional publishers, especially for the DCI Logan series, but also for new stuff. And I've always said no. I've been happy doing it myself. And then I came up with two books, an idea for two different books, which are completely disconnected from my DCI Logan universe.
Mm-hmm.
Still sort of crime, but very, very different. And I had no idea what I was going to do with those. And a publisher, quite a new publisher called Bookature, they're actually owned by Hachette, I think, now they've been taken over. Yes. But they're very much got a sort of indie publisher mindset, and they're digital first, and they're really sort of data-driven, so they know what people are interested in, and they know how they ultimate the covers look like. They do all that sort of research. And they said, if you get anything else you'd like to do that we could sort of collaborate on. So my publishing company is now collaborating with them to release two new books by me, which are sort of psychological thrillers,
right,
which are coming out in July and August next year. But otherwise, I'm just doing it all myself. I would never kind of go back to just being an author writing for a traditional publisher, because I think that model is essentially broken, you know. But I, as an author writing for a traditional publisher, I got 7.5% royalty on the paperbacks that publisher sold. As a self-publisher publishing on Kindle, you know, if I publish a Kindle book at £2.99, I will make £2.10 from every copy sold. If a publisher sells a £6.99 paperback via Amazon, I'll make 10 pence per copy sold. So I think that model, certainly from the author's point of view, is broken. And I think it's I would never go back to that form of traditional publishing. And I've had, you know, some lovely offers and lovely advances offered and all that stuff. And it would be giving up far too much sort of control and creative freedom. And it would be giving up far too much money at the end of the day to do that.
Yeah. It's fascinating how, as you say, everything has to change in publishing, doesn't it? Every time I go to the London Book Fair, which is where I first encountered you and heard you speaking, I thought you'd be a great Goldster interviewee, which indeed you are. I just find how much publishing has changed since I first started straight out of university as a book editor. And it hasn't changed fast enough. And you're right.
Oh, I think that's it. Really, and I think now they're, you know, author earnings at the lowest point in history, essentially. And I know, you know, even advances that I was being offered 10, 12 years ago just don't exist now. And the advances I've been offered then, my agent was saying, well, this is nothing like the advances that were being offered 10 years ago.
Exactly.
So, you know, authors have been offered, you know, you get an advance of £2,000. Now that £2,000 is paid in three installments. It's paid when you sign the contract, it's paid when you deliver the final draft of the manuscript, and it's paid when that manuscript's published. Now, those things might be 3 years apart. So that £2,000 is suddenly you're getting 600 odd quid a year for 3 years. And then that £2,000 has to be earned back at potentially 10 pence per copy sold before you can actually start making money.
Yeah.
Now, when I put a book up for pre-order on Amazon, a Kindle edition, so let's just say I get 10,000 pre-orders for a book, and I know that I make £2.10 per copy sold, on day one, I earn 10,000 times £2.10.
Yeah, well.
I don't have to pay that back. That's just my money that I will be paid in 2 months' time. Now, traditional publishing will generally pay you every 6 months. And even then, you have to chase them half the time and say, you forgot to pay me. And they say, oh, well, sorry, we'll put it through in the next payment run in 6 months' time. And you go, well, no, don't do that. Pay me now. Because you know that the staff in the publishing company wouldn't be happy if they said, we forgot to pay your wages this month, but we'll just pay you next month instead. Is that all right? They would say, no, because I've got a mortgage I need to pay, so I need that money now. But they don't sort of extend that courtesy, by and large, to authors. And the bigger publishers are worse. You know, I find smaller publishers, I've worked with many of them, and they're great, and they understand. And then you go to sort of HarperCollins, who owned Big News International, and it's just a corporation, and they don't really seem to have any understanding that people actually need to be paid for what they're doing.
Yeah, I've always found the same. The big publishers that you think it's going to be really exciting to be published by are never as good as the small publishers. So let's get on to self-publishing. And I know that you're going to tell us a bit about your online course, and I'm going to send people a link to that as well. But tell us, if you can, your top tips for self-publishing.
Top tips for self-publishing. I would say my main top tip, the most important thing, is to ask yourself why you want to publish a book. Because once you ask yourself why and you honestly answer that question, then that dictates the entire direction of what you do next. So there are many reasons to publish a book. You might decide you've just got a story you want to tell and you want it to be available to the world, which is fine. You might decide you want to leave this legacy for your grandchildren or whoever to read about, you know, this idea you had or a sort of a memoir you've written about your life. That's great as well. At the other end of that, you might go, I want to, you know, form a 7-figure publishing company. And that's a different mindset that you need entirely to just go in and putting this book out for a bit of fun. So I say the first thing to figure out is why you want to publish that book. And that will shape all the decisions you make from that point going forward. That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely it does. Yeah. So tell us, you have an online course that you're offering. Do you want to tell us what the impetus for that was?
Yeah, absolutely. So a few years ago, I was asked to speak at a publishing conference down in London, and it was about how to self-publish a book with no money, because a lot of people at that point were signing up to, you know, like vanity publishers who were saying, pay us £2,000 and we'll put your book on Amazon. And I'd obviously done it all for free myself, you know, from everything from designer covers to editing to marketing and all that stuff. I'd done without spending any money because I had no money to spend. So I did this sort of session at this conference, and it was called bookstrapping, because, you know, the idea of if you bootstrap a business, you do it without spending any money. So bookstrapping was bootstrapping a publishing business. So I did that and it went down really well. Lots of people kind of asked me questions and I would get emails about it quite frequently. And then when the JD Kirk stuff really took off, it got to the stage when I'm getting, you know, 10, 20 emails a week from people saying, how do I self-publish a book? How do I do what you've done, essentially? So I answered as many as I could, but if I answered them all, then I would have no time to write my own books. So I sort of gathered all those questions up, and I gathered up all my material from the session I did in London. And I thought, I'll do a short sort of, just a little course, few pages of what I did. And it sort of snowballed into 50,000 words of 30 lessons and 10 video lessons and all kinds of stuff. So I decided to make that available. It's going to be coming out in October. It costs lifetime access, will cost £69. There are courses out there that cost, you know, £10,000, and I hate all that sort of exploitation side of it. So I thought, I'll make it £69. If you join the waiting list now, you get a 40% discount on that. And that gives you lifetime access to the course, to all updates, a little community, access to a community where I'm answering questions. People can literally go, this is my blurb for my book. What do you think? And I can give feedback on it. And I thought that was just an easier way of presenting all that information, that instead of sending out to people every week or, you know, responding to their emails.
And so listening on the podcast, I'm just going to read out the link, which is link.jdkirk.com/learn. And at the moment, that'll take you to the waiting list. And as Barry said, that'll give you a 40% discount on the £69 cost of the course when it goes live in October. And if you're listening to this on the podcast after October 2023, it's all still available, is it, to join?
Yeah, it will all be available there, be available kind of forever is the plan, and I'll update it as new stuff happens. So I just finished it, and then Amazon changed some rules on AI-generated cover art and things, so I've now had to update it already. Before it's even out, I've had to update it. So I'll be updating it all the time, but it's still quicker doing that than responding individually to all the emails.
And so we've got a question here. Are you looking to publish other authors as well?
Yes, we are, but in much fairer terms than sort of traditional publishing has done. So we'll be looking at like an even split, rather than the author getting 7.5%. It'll be like an even 50-50 between publisher and author. We're starting in January next year. We're republishing some out of print Scottish crime fiction as like a test to see how it goes, to make sure that it all works. Because really it should. I mean, really, as I say, we've built a publishing company that at the moment only publishes my books. So if we take out my books and slot in someone else's books, the company should still continue to perform all the same tasks as it currently does. So that's the hope anyway. So if those books are going to be three coming out, one in January, one in February, one in March. The author is called Bill Knox, and the books were written in the 50s and 60s and set around Glasgow, and was really successful at the time and had been out of print for a while. So we got in touch with his family and we're bringing those back. And those will be our sort of litmus test to see where we go next. But the plan certainly is next year we'll be opening up to other authors.
Brilliant. And how are you planning to source those authors? Are you hoping people will come to you, or are there certain people that you are planning to approach?
It's a bit of both, really. We will be opening up to people to submit. So if you go to Zertex Media, that's Z-E-R-T-E-X, zertexmedia.com, and join the email list there, then as soon as we're open for submissions, we will email people to let them know.
Great.
Zertex, I should say, Zertex Media is the name of the publishing company. Zertex are the villains in the Space Team series of books. They're this galactic corporation that just does evil. And I thought it would be quite fun to name the publishing company after those guys.
So with all the writing that you've done, have you got any film or TV interest in your books?
Yeah, we've got quite a bit, actually. There's lots of ongoing discussions around the DCI Logan series in particular. Some of my children's books, I've been back and forth to Hollywood because they're in development over there. Kind of most excitingly at the moment, I suppose, a couple of months ago, on my J.D. Kirk Facebook page, I shared just a random idea for a horror movie set in the islands about midges, the wee insects that, you know, eat you alive. And I thought they're the sort of scariest Scottish creature. And I made some AI art using Midjourney of just these people screaming and being chased by little bugs. And I put it on Facebook and my audience really liked it. And then the BBC got in touch and said, we'd like to interview you about this midges thing. And I went, okay, that's fine. So they did an interview and that went out on radio and on their website. And then at that point, my phone just started ringing nonstop for the next sort of 3 or 4 days.
Wow.
And it was American press and I was, you know, all the sort of UK newspapers and were covering, running stories on this midges thing. So off the back of that, we've now got a director attached, got a producer in the US who's worked on like the Purge horror series he's doing the Reacher, the Jack Reacher series for Amazon at the moment. And so that's kind of build momentum. I've written the script for that and we're looking to shoot that next year in Scotland, is the plan.
That's
so it all just came from a daft little thing on social media.
And you are on several different social media platforms. How much time do you spend on social media? Is it worth it?
No, generally very little, really. I mean, Facebook for me is the big one. My audience is mostly on Facebook. And I think that's another good self-publishing tip is think of who your audience is for your books. There's very little point in me dancing on TikTok because, you know, my audience for crime fiction, by and large, is women aged over 45. Now that's the majority. That's not exclude that, you know, the audience aren't exclusively made up of women over 45, but that's most of the audience for crime fiction. And they're generally found on Facebook. They're generally not on TikTok, or they're generally not on Instagram. But if you were writing, you know, young adult fantasy novels, then your audience probably isn't on Facebook. They're probably on TikTok. They're probably on Instagram. So I spend most of my social media time on Facebook, but even that's very little. You know, I can schedule some stuff and I probably spend 3 or 4 hours a week on Facebook and minutes on the rest of them, if that.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Well, this has been amazing. I'm getting so many comments in from people saying how much they've enjoyed today and how much.
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
I just think it's really inspirational how you started this. Just, you know, out of a traditional publishing thing, thought I'm fed up with it. I want to do it for myself. And what a huge success it's been. So thank you so much for coming along today. It's been really fascinating talking to you. I'm just going to tell everybody what is coming up next on Goldster, if you don't mind bearing with me. So just to say that Humphrey is with you next week. And on Thursday, 28th of September, he's going to be talking to Austin S. Camacho, the author of Subtle Felonies. We know he's been on Goldster before. I know you're all a fan of his. And he'll be back talking about Hannibal Jones, troubleshooter, fighter of evil, and a dogged investigator who finds himself up against organized crime and city corruption. And then on Friday next week, Humphrey's back with Book of the Month, and this is Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And I'm also going to give him a couple of books that you can all choose from, what you're going to do with me for book club next month. Now, next week, the week after that, I'm back on the 5th of October. We're doing another Riverstone Live, which, of course, please still come to on Zoom, just as any other Goldster. But if you want to come and join us in London, I will be talking to the BBC correspondent Rory Kethlin-Jones about his new memoir, Ruskin Park, Sylvia, Me and the BBC. He's also going to be talking a bit about living with Parkinson's disease, which is what he's going through at the moment. And then Humphrey is back on the 6th of October talking to AJ Chambers, author of The Vicar, a debut thriller. We do actually do things other than crime fiction. As you all know, we normally do lots of different things. I was here yesterday with Julie Summers talking about her nonfiction set in the Second World War. So, and then I'm back with another crime writer on the 12th of October. I'm talking to Jim Kelly. And then on the 13th of October, I am going to be talking to Ruth Lee, who is going to be talking about her new book based on Jane Austen. It's called A Great Deal of Ingenuity, and it's a collection of new stories inspired by the characters in Pride and Prejudice. It's really good fun for any Jane Austen fans. Definitely come along. She's just come up with some great ideas. It really is ingenious, and it makes you think about all the background research she's done into the lives of those characters. Got lots of comments coming in here, and somebody has said, great to see and listen to one of my favourite authors.
Thank you.
Got some good Goldster fans here. Thank you, everybody. Have a great weekend. Anybody who happens to be in Liverpool, I'm just about to jump on a train there tonight. I'm doing a literary festival tonight. I'm going to be on Penny Lane. I can't tell you how exciting that is.
Nice.
You grew up with a mum who loved the Beatles, so I'm very excited. So come along and see you there. And lots of compliments coming in for you. Great talk. Thanks so much. Fantastic. Really was.
Thank you.
Have a great holiday. Enjoy some time off. And
thank you very much. Yeah.
When you're back.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.